call special committee on energy to order. This is March 26, 2014, and present with us Representative Nagyak, Representative Hughes, and myself, Representative Isaacson. Representative Millett, co-chair, is excused, and I've got from the LIO, we've got Thatcher from the recording studios of Juneau. We've got Debbie Tillinghast. My committee aide is Catherine Aldemar. So today we have the opportunity to have a presentation from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power with Gwen Haldeman, director, and Anthony Scott, energy economist, is on the phone. We're going to hear a program and projects overview, but also we're going to be looking at funding energy projects. This is important because the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which is not going to be heard in this committee, but we need to get this through the process, through the House and then into the Senate, and get that passed, because if we don't, it's $2 million at stake. Well, Gwen is going to explain some of that aspect to us, but also working relationships between the state and industry. So we have to leave at 9 o'clock for caucus, and so unfortunately we'll be cut short. So if we can hold our questions to a minimum, let her get through her presentation and then ask the questions. And I know that one of our members might have to slip out. And I know, I think Joseph, Representative Josephson is sick, so he wouldn't be here. And I think Rep. Foster is excused as well on a previous excuse. So, Gwen, with that, take it away.
Thank you very much, Representative Isaacson. Really appreciate the opportunity to come here and give a little bit of information on the kinds of projects that we're working on, and especially those that are relevant to a lot of the conversations that are happening around the state today. You know, this is a pretty exciting time for the state, for our communities. There's a lot of important decisions being made, and what I really want to tailor our comments around is the kinds of work that we're doing that can contribute to that conversation and provide information for you and other decision makers in the state as well. With that in mind, I did tailor the ASAP programs and project examples. I'd like to just give an overview of ASAP in general and then talk a little bit about just some of the projects that we're doing and are involved in right now that are ongoing. It's just an example of the kinds of work that we do. And with that being said, I've asked Anthony Scott, who's one of our energy economists, to join us because he's been leading our energy analysis group, which is a small group that we have that includes research, several researchers from throughout the university system. And Anthony's been working on some studies that I think are exemplary of the kinds of work that we can do, not necessarily on an engineering basis, but looking at the economics and looking at potential other things that impact or go into policy-related decisions. And for that reason, I've asked him to join us. He has a background with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and the Division of Oil and Gas before coming to work at the university and at ASAP in our Anchorage office. So I'm going to have him just talk about a few of the studies he's been doing. As I mentioned, there's been some questions that have come out of this committee relevant to specific technologies that we've followed in that past, whether that be ground source heat pumps or whether that be small modular nuclear reactors. And so I'm just going to address those projects as well and the work that we're continuing to do to follow those kinds of technology options for Alaska, whether they're near term or things that are happening today or whether they may be relevant at some point in the future. We feel like that's one of our roles, is to be tracking those kinds of technologies. Throughout my presentation, I'll talk about our working relationships with state agencies and industry, because that is fundamentally part of what we do. This program was designed as a very interdisciplinary program. I can't think of a single project that we do where we do not have external partners, both in state agencies and industry. And internally, we work with researchers throughout the university system. We're pretty agnostic in terms of where they're actually housed, on which campus, which research unit. We want to use the best minds in this state and apply them to the kinds of energy challenges that we're facing today. And finally, I did want to make a few comments on Representative Isaacson mentioned the Emerging Tech Program and just funding energy projects generally, energy research, those kinds of things, and why it's important. These are all kinds of components to a larger strategy that I see us embarking on in this state, and I think they're all kind of critical components. So with that being said, I'll just really quickly give an overview on the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. We were organized about 5 years ago, essentially as a gateway to energy research at the University of Alaska. We are based at UAF, have a satellite office in Anchorage, and about 20 dedicated staff, mostly engineers, that work for our program, and then about 35 affiliated faculty that are, as I mentioned, are spread all over the university system. Many of them don't consider themselves to be energy researchers. We have fish biologists, we have economists, geologists, whoever we need to pull into a project to make it successful. We find a group, we figure out what the challenge is, what the issue is that Alaskans are facing, whether it's communities, whether it's industry, and we pull together a group of researchers specifically around that problem, and really some of the best minds in the state. And then also, when we need, we draw in expertise from outside the state. Today, in Fairbanks, we have researchers from Australia that are working on small microgrids that are at our lab right now working with us. We have a researcher from Idaho National Lab. That group is going to Cordova tomorrow to work on a hydro project there with the utility. I'm actually headed to Elam tomorrow, for example. So we work all over the state as well. We also engage students. 50 students is about the number that we fund on an annual basis through the projects that we're working on. We touch a lot more students than that. They're Alaska students. We really look and seek students that are either UA students today, or we have an intern program where we try to attract Alaska students that grew up here, that are high achievers, that have left the state for their education. We're trying to bring them back to Alaska to spend their summer here, to be engaged with our industry and community and energy research in the state, to try to show them that there are real opportunities and jobs, you know, here for them. A lot of our students are working in industry in the state as well. Our recent graduates are at BP, at Shell, at Ocean Renewable Power Company, and a number of our other industry partners where our students have received positions today. Given the constraints that we're working around as a state in terms of funding and some of the really difficult decisions that you're making, I think one of the messages I really want to get across is that a program like ours is not a cost center. It's really a revenue-generating center for both the university and for the state. We've been around for 6 years, I mentioned. It's a fairly new research program within the university system. Over that time period, we've received a little bit over $3 million in state funding through the university's operating budget. And so that's an average of about $500,000 a year. We're in our sixth year right now. And during that time period, we've received a total of $26 million in external grants and contracts to do applied energy research that's of immediate relevance to Alaska. That's what we focus on. We don't do basic research. It's got to have an immediate relevance to what's going on in the state.
Representative Hughes.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. The $26 million, the external grants means not through the state then?
Some of those are actually awarded through, for example, the Alaska Energy Authority. We've received some funding through AEA for partnering with the Emerging Tech Program, but it's actually a fairly small percentage that's through the state, maybe a quarter. Another good chunk is through private sector, through industry, for example. There's a vendor from outside the state that's coming to Fairbanks to test a flywheel technology for about $500,000 that they're now investing in Alaska. And we're starting to try to track that, like what's our actual economic impact for the research we're doing. And we don't have numbers around that right now. But some of those are state dollars that we're receiving either competitively or through directed research.
So you're not really, for every $1 that you get, you accumulate nine or get nine. You're not quite there, is what you're saying, because some of that is still state money that you're leveraging.
That's absolutely correct, and that is actually a good point. Next time I'll make sure. I actually normally have this pie chart that shows which portion is from AEA, and I took that out, or from the state, basically, and I took that out. It's roughly a quarter of our budget, and those are either competitive awards, like, for example, Representative Foster would be aware of this project we're doing out at Pilgrim Hot Springs near Nome. A portion of that was funded through the Renewable Energy Fund, as an example. And so most of it was not, but a chunk of it, actually about a third of that project was funded through the state. So that's an example.
It's very good to note that they do leverage that money. You're leveraging it to get other money that isn't coming out of state coffers. And for the record, Representative Higgins has joined us. Excellent.
So just to continue on in terms of that funding, you know, so essentially, as you mentioned, Representative Isaacson, for every $1 that we bring in, we leverage that $1 that we receive from the state directly. We leverage that with about $9 you know, I can work out the numbers in terms of how much of that is outside the state versus inside the state dollars. In truth, we've actually been trying much harder to try to increase the amount of partnerships that we have within the state of Alaska. The vast majority of our projects are with Alaska partners. In the past, energy research has been funded largely through the federal government. And what that means, from my perspective, I'm from private sector, I think of it as who's your client. And when the federal government or somebody from outside Alaska is your client, they're driving the research direction. And so they're really driving the results that you're developing and the direction that your program's taking. And so I've really actually worked pretty hard to try to diversify our funding portfolio and try to bring in more private investment and partnership with the university. That's been a really big deal to me, and I'm really proud to say that the in terms of numbers, not dollar numbers, but the actual number of projects, we have the largest amount with private sector partners. So that's pretty exciting to me. And so our goal has been to actually try to increase that partnership with the state and our communities here. And to add on to that, about 40% of those dollars that we bring in, I actually added this up over the weekend, goes to fund small businesses here in Alaska. You know, everything from John's Machine Shop up in Fairbanks to MW Drilling in the Valley. You know, these are small businesses in Alaska that we're using as subcontractors, because if there's an opportunity where small business can do that work, we don't want to compete with them. Our goal is to try to fill the gaps and try to do the work that private sector isn't capable of doing in the state for whatever reason, because they don't have the skills or they don't have the resources, and try to use private contractors wherever we possibly can to do what they do best, which is whether that's build equipment or help us, you know, do the actual field work for some of our research programs. That's what we're doing. And then the other point is about $2 of those $9 goes to actually fund the base operating costs of the university. You know, just like any small business, the university has overhead. And $2 of that $9 roughly that we bring in actually goes to fund those base operating costs, to keep the lights on, to keep the university operating. And so we're, in a way, you know, the dollars that we're bringing in is helping make the university a more sustainable operation overall. And of course, these are, you know, we're talking millions of dollars here. It's not huge, but I do think this is an opportunity to just kind of showcase ways that we can make our state government more sustainable while we're doing work that I think does have relevance to our communities and our industries here in the state. Does that make sense? So I'm going to turn it over to Anthony here in a second to dive down in a little bit of detail on a couple, briefly, on a couple projects that we're working on. But when I look at what our role of the University of Alaska, and the Alaska Center for Energy and Power more specifically is, it's really about developing information for decision makers at all levels, whether that's homeowners, whether that's our industries, whether that's you here in the legislature. We want to provide information to help people make decisions. And we do that in three ways: through technology testing and optimization. I'll talk a little bit about that briefly in a minute. Energy analysis, which is really what Anthony has been building in terms of a program focus area at ASAP. And data management, which is something that we work with our partners at the Alaska Energy Authority on, to understand how our projects are actually performing and making that data available, because it's public dollars that are funding a lot of these projects, so that other people can make good decisions about what to invest in for their own community or from an industrial perspective. We prepare students to work in energy-related disciplines. It's super important to us to involve students. We have a robust summer intern program. Whenever we can get students involved, we do that. We're super competitive. We hire about one student for every 9 applications that we get. And then commercializing energy innovation. This is something that Representative Isaacson, I know, is interested in. We're extremely interested in as well. How can we take advantage of the challenges that we have in the state to develop new IP and new ideas in the university, or partnering with private sector, that can actually generate new wealth for the state and new opportunities for economic growth? So the Energy Analysis Group, these are just a smattering of examples of ongoing projects. So I'm going to turn it over to Anthony, if he's available, to just provide a little bit of detail on what he's doing, and these are just 4 small examples.
Anthony, if you put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Anthony Scott. I'm with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I'm very pleased to be joining you this morning. So again, as Glenn mentioned, these are a sample of things that we're working on. I'm only going to talk a little bit in some depth about the last one of these, but just to give you a flavor. Number one is a project that we've had ongoing now for over a year, using a lot of student labor good research work. What we're trying to do is really get a better handle on what causes variation in fuel prices in different communities around the state. As you well know, diesel fuel prices are determined by very periodic or occasional lifts from refineries. And so for a place like Nome, for example, the utility there may receive only a single delivery of fuel oil, which then determines the price for the entire year. It is the critical thing to better understand to be able to benchmark alternative energies or solutions of any kind, whether they're LNG opportunities, energy conservation, geothermal, wind, what have you. So the idea basically is to sharpen our pencils so that we've got better data and better information to make more efficient decisions, both on the public sector and critically the private sector, so that they understand the thing that they're shooting against. I've also been working with AEA on a project to do a critical assessment of previous work and in assess in light of current conditions the economics of a Southeast Alaska BC transmission intertie, looking at new models for bringing private investment into renewable energy in Alaska. And in some cases, it turns out it appears that private money can actually provide lower cost power than public investment. And that's quite surprising, or at least it was to me, but it can make sense when you recognize that the federal government provides from time to time quite substantial investment tax credits and tax deductions for private money. And when the state makes those investments, it obviously can't take advantage of the federal tax benefits that are offered. So there are circumstances in which private money can be brought to bear to provide real benefits for Alaskans. As well, I'm particularly, this is a subject which is near and dear to my heart, because as public dollars grow more scarce, I think we all need to sharpen our pencils and figure out how to bring more private investment into the state. So the last subject I'd like to talk with you a little bit about is an economic assessment and screening at a very high level that is work that's still ongoing, but pretty much wrapping up, for the Alaska Energy Authority to look at economics of very small-scale LNG to displace diesel in powerhouses in coastal communities in Alaska. You probably are familiar with efforts that Westpac, which is a private company, has been engaged in to bring very small-scale LNG and ISO containers up from British Columbia into Alaska. There's also potentially opportunities for exporting out from Cook Inlet to other areas of the state. On the next slide, you can see why this commercial opportunity exists now. And the reason, as we all know, is that oil prices and natural gas prices have substantially moved apart in recent years. And that very substantial gap between the cost or pricing of those two products, heating oil or diesel and natural gas, has created opportunities for economically bringing natural gas in. It's not technological innovation particularly. It's just that the cost of transport and storage of natural gas in ISO containers can now be covered, at least potentially in some cases, given this substantial spread in costs. So Sarah Fisher Goad, who's AEA's director, asked me to take a look at, well, whether this looked like indeed a viable solution for communities, and we wanted to understand at a very high level whether where in the sort of worst case scenario, which is sort of ISO container transport and storage of LNG, which is the most expensive compared to bulk transport, whether this offered solutions. So, excuse me?
No question yet. Well, yes, we do. If Representative Nagyak brings his mic, he's got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, you're concentrating on LNG, and that's going to cost some money to for infrastructure in the villages and all that, pipelines and to connect in the villages. Is there another way, like propane, to use that as a source for fuel and other uses?
That's through the chair. I personally have not looked at propane recently. It's something which we looked at some when I was with the Division of Oil and Gas. I think there are potentially some opportunities for looking at propane. Pricing of propane compared to natural gas right now, anyway, is not as favorable, and there are infrastructure needs there as well. I do need to clarify that for the study that we were looking at here, we were really looking only at the opportunities for displacing diesel for electricity generation as opposed to home heating, which is potentially something which propane could do with somewhat less infrastructure investment. The reason why we were looking at LNG for power generation is, again, because that requires the least amount of capital investment at the village level. And so we wanted to see for the easiest case whether there was a business case to be made for bringing LNG into villages for power generation. Once that starts, then it raises the opportunity for building on that subsequently to look at opportunities for heat. But this study did not look at propane. Propane is potentially viable, but again, we were really looking at trying to understand understand the opportunities that appear to be being raised by this private investor, which is pursuing this right now.
So we have basically half an hour. We need to rip through this. Go ahead and proceed to this worst-case scenario. How, if you're just doing electric utility loads in the bush, can you also get your economies of scale with 10,000 MMBTU?
Very good, Mr. Chair. Proceeding to the next slide 9, one of the things that we found was that the electric load in coastal communities in Alaska, even if you aggregate it all together, remains small. If you take essentially all coastal communities from Wade, Hampton, well, not quite, from Bethel to the east, including Southeast, you don't get to the 10,000 MMBTU a day that you would need. So aggregating electric load all by itself is not going to get you to that threshold. To get to that threshold, one's going to need industrial loads as well. And that's just sort of indicated schematically here by this next slide, by this slide here, slide 9. Nevertheless, there are some substantial industrial loads, whether they're fish processing or refining loads at Valdez or otherwise, and potentially mining loads in Southeast. And those at least hold out the opportunity for creating sufficient economies of scale to get a project going. So assuming that a project could get going with industrial loads, we tried to look at whether indeed the economics of storage and transport using isocontainment makes sense. And for ice-free communities, and this is shown on slide 10, it appears that it might. This is a difficult slide in some ways, but what it does is tries to illustrate both break-even costs and the risks associated with going to a new fuel. Break-even costs for LNG, of course, would be determined in part by diesel costs, right? I mean, if your diesel costs are high, then it's much easier for an LNG project to make sense than if diesel costs are low, and of course, diesel costs experience substantial volatility, and that's what's shown by the black bars, basically, is the range of break-even costs generated by the range in diesel prices across a number of different ice-free communities around the state. And in general, one of the things that it appears is that it doesn't particularly matter if you're a small ice-free coastal community or a large one. If enough load can be put together, diesel might well be displaced by LNG for power production, which I actually think is a very exciting opportunity.
For the record, let it be known, Representative Foster is here. Thank you. Anthony, if you would explain the red line across the bottom, because you've got these black lines that are descriptive of MMBTU ranges, but not necessarily, I forget if that's X and Y or Y and X, whatever axis that is.
Along the x-axis, and I just sort of blanked them out because I didn't want to confuse discussion, are basically each black line here represents a community.
Okay.
These are community-specific economics, power-specific economics for separate communities. Along the y-axis, I have ranges of break-even natural gas costs that indicate whether LNG purchase prices could favorably compare with diesel given the capital investment required. And what this indicates is that, for example, for the community that's bracketed in yellow, in 2012, one could acquire natural gas prices in British Columbia for as much as, say, $18 per MMBTU. In 2010, and still have the project pay off compared with diesel, in 2010, when diesel prices were considerably lower, you could purchase natural gas for as much as, say, $7 and still have the project break even compared to diesel. And the point of the red line is to indicate that, indeed, natural gas can be purchased at prices over this historical period. Natural gas could indeed be purchased for substantially less than these ranges. And that indicates that there is a real opportunity for LNG to work in ice-free coastal communities, assuming, of course, again, that enough industrial load can be pulled in to make a project work. So the red line, again, is the average natural gas price between 2010 and 2012 in British Columbia that would be purchased to then subsequently transport, to liquefy, transport, and then use in power plants in Alaska. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, thank you. So go ahead and explain that then to the ICE bound.
Okay, well, so for the slide 11 shows the same concept. Again, each black line is a different coastal community. But these now are communities that are further to the west and are shut off from regular ocean transport for many months during the year. Notionally, say about 6 months, 7 months of the year. And for those communities, of course, you need to store much more LNG to get you through the winter load, and that adds to the capital costs that are required. Unfortunately, what this indicates is that for many of these communities, it's that additional capital cost of storage undermines the economics of LNG use in powerhouses in these communities. Again, the red line is showing what the average natural gas price was in BC during this historical period. And what we see is that it cuts through the black lines for many of these communities. In some cases, it's fully above the black lines for communities. And what that, again, indicates is that if you were importing natural gas to use in place of diesel, the delivered cost of power would probably end up being higher than if you were to continue to just use diesel. In other words, the projects wouldn't pay off for ICE-free communities.
Anthony, a question on this, though.
Yes.
If you're bringing, this is small scale, you're bringing up ISO tanks that can be stored independently, it would seem, and perhaps in sequence. If you're going to just bring up ISO, you don't really have storage tank issues, do you? So how does this really differ? You've got diesel storage that's already in place. I take it that that's the fundamental baseline. You got the red line says $3.82. I take it that's an MMBCF and or BTU. And then you've got on both pages that same thing, but it raises, and you said that that was due to storage costs. But again, then that goes back to the ISO tanks. What's the value of using ISO tanks if you also have to develop larger storage capacities?
So it's a really excellent question, and I apologize for not having time to sort of lead through the entire value chain of LNG. The ISO containers are indeed storage. They are themselves storage. They store the LNG without any boil off for up to 90 days, which is really quite remarkable, well, 60 days, which is pretty remarkable. So the ISO containers themselves are storage, Representative Isaacson. It's that for a given amount of fuel to get through the winter, need more ISO containers that would be, say, delivered in September, for example.
Gotcha. It's that 60-day limit.
The fuel within those ISO containers would be used at the powerhouse through the winter until you could replace them, take them off site, and then replace them right with full containers again in the spring. So an ice-free community, however, when they use up the natural gas, the LNG, within an ISO container, they can just receive prompt delivery of a new ISO container, and so in effect they need fewer dollars of capital devoted to ISO containers per unit of fuel burned.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay. So there are a couple of that I've circled here, ICE bound communities where it looks like LNG might indeed be able to work. And I'll go ahead and call them out. This is Dillingham and Naknek, actually, and it's because they have relatively large loads. And indeed, their loads are large enough that if you used, instead of ISO containers for these communities, but instead used bulk delivery and bulk storage, and that's just a different mode of LNG transport and storage, But if you had larger bulk storage vessels, the economies of scale of those are better for these communities, and they have enough load, Dillingham and Necker, that even there, it might well be economic because they've got enough load to use LNG. So the takeaways of this is that economies of scale, of course, matter, and critically, economies of scope matter. We're going to, for this kind of a solution to work, we will need some larger industrial loads that want to play along. And Westpac has been doing really good yeoman's work trying to line up and corral potential customers to take a harder look and then maybe eventually move forward with a commercial effort. I absolutely applaud their efforts. I think it's really a quite exciting opportunity, and based on my work anyway, I'm fairly convinced that it's LNG is potentially an option for use in ice-free communities. For ice-bound communities, I think it's going to be a harder lift. Again, another, one of the things that it appears is that a more bulk project, which would be based in Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Dillingham, Naknek, this would be a non-ISO project, substantially relying upon fish processor loads, to create the economies of scale that are required, that might well be possible. And it's also possible that a southeast ISO-based project might be able to proceed. The economics of ISO containers seem to work. For that to be the case, again, probably is going to need some larger industrial loads. The economies get better as you put together bigger loads. What's very exciting to me about this is there's a real opportunity here, and it's quite possible and indeed likely what this result seems to indicate is the state really doesn't need to do very much to make it work.
And this is important. I appreciate what you're saying. I think we all do, because as we contemplate the gas line, then this becomes something that we can make sure that we provide benefit for all of Alaska. So any questions of this portion? And then we're going to skip to some highlights, nuclear, thermal heat pumps, et cetera, with 15 minutes to go.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you, Anthony.
Thank you.
All right. So, yeah, I apologize that this.
I apologize that we had a caucus meeting that came up, so this is
understand.
Why we're
instructed. So this is an example of some of the work that we're doing with AEA, for example. So you were asking about state contracts for representative use. This is the example of kind of directed research where they have a question that's coming from several communities. We're able to respond and do some of that work on behalf of our agencies and other entities in the state. We work on rural energy issues. We work on community energy solutions. Another study Anthony did was relevant to interior energy options. And then we also work on larger scale stuff related to industry. We'd like to be doing more work also on fossil energy work to support those industries. But right now there's not state funding to support that kind of research. So I'm just going to skip ahead here. We have a lab up in Fairbanks that some of you have visited where we do a lot of product testing. We also work with communities in the field to do testing. We're trying to really push stuff out into the field. For example, where we test stuff and then we often have things that go directly into the field. We're working on IP development. That's a whole other topic I'm not going to focus on right now. Ground and seawater source heat pumps, this has been of significant interest in the state. Actually, the last time I was down here in Juneau, I was speaking with a few folks that are based here in Juneau, and there's been a real increase in the amount of these kinds of systems that have been installed. And the person I was speaking to actually credited the work that we've done with at least some of that activity. We've done a fairly extensive investigation, collecting data from systems, and then going ahead and analyzing performance. Where does this make sense? Where can it make sense? In cold weather operations, there's a lot of challenges related to these systems. When you have high electric costs, they're not necessarily going to perform effectively, not just due to climate, but you also still need electricity to operate many of these devices. So just as an example, Anthony talked about more of an economic analysis. These are more technical reports. These are online, and I think that at least one of them is in your packet. They're work that we've done in collaboration with the Denali Commission, with the Alaska Energy Authority, and others like the Cold Climate Housing Research Center to look at whether these are feasible options for a homeowner, whether it's in Wasilla or wherever they might be located in the state. Is this something that might be applicable for you, and how much fuel is it going to save? That's the kind of more technical engineering analysis that we've done in this particular case. Small modular nuclear reactors. This was actually a request initially that came directly out of the legislature to take a look at this as an option for Alaska. We put together a pretty extensive review of this in March 2011. Here's a report that we have for this one. There's a picture of it. And, you know, at the time, and of course this was right around the time of the Fukushima incident in Japan with the tsunami, the basic conclusion that we came to is this is a potentially viable technology for Alaska, but it is not going to be commercially available anytime on the kinds of horizon that we're going to be making decisions in the near term. But once we start to track a technology, we try to continue to keep our foot in the door and continue to follow that. We don't just consider a project to be ended. And so this is a perfect example where we're sending three of our students to Idaho National Lab this summer to participate in the design of a 1 megawatt small modular reactor that's actually for NASA. But we're also curious to know if there's any chance there could be potential civilian applications. We are not, we're agnostic in terms of technology, so it isn't really a matter of are we pro or not pro nuclear. And of course, one of the things that we really want to understand is how waste management and replacement of fuel would occur. And so this is something that we're just continuing to work on and track because we think that it's our job to basically make sure people have information. So that's that. This is just another example of that. And our projects are obviously statewide. We work all over the state. I mentioned that tomorrow I'm headed to Elam to work with them on a geothermal project. So a lot of those projects are listed in our at-a-glance that you have as well. Speaking of which, geothermal energy for Nome, and the reason why I think I want to illustrate this is because it's a good example of us working closely with a community, with researchers inside the university to pull in expertise from groups like the Remote Sensing Group that don't necessarily think of themselves as energy researchers, but we've applied their expertise to this particular project. And the thing that I think is actually pretty exciting about this one, beyond just the fact, you know, that we were involved in this work in Nome, is that there's really an opportunity here. Forget about what the energy source is. Every region and every community in the state has different local energy options, and that's really what we're focused on, is developing local energy options, whether that's coal or geothermal, and anything in between that. And so I just received this letter yesterday from Nome Joint Utilities thanking us for the work that we've done. I'm going to hand that to Representative Foster. You know, what we've done is we've really worked at this problem from a very multidisciplinary standpoint. Anthony's been really involved with the economics and the providing information to develop a power purchase agreement. We've been doing the resource evaluation. We've been figuring out what the potential challenges for integrating geothermal on an islanded grid is. We've kind of done work related to this project from a lot of different aspects, and I think that this letter thanks us for that really multifaceted assistance to the community and the developer as well. What's interesting about this is it goes back to what Anthony said. There is a role for private financing. I think that we are sometimes assuming that we cannot use and cannot attract private financing to some of these energy projects for the state because we're too small, too remote, all those kinds of things. And I think Nome is actually, in my mind, an example of a really proactive approach to developing, to working with independent power producers, entering into power purchase agreements, whether that's to develop a wind farm using private financing or now potentially geothermal. They're on the verge of signing a power purchase agreement to develop a geothermal plant in Nome. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen because there's still some, you know, resource work that needs to be done. But the fact is that there's a really good chance here that a company could come into Nome and spend $40 million to build a generation project to serve Nome. And I think that that's a really exciting concept and something that, yes, that's for Nome, but that is the kind of thing that we can be looking at for the Rail Belt and all different kinds of places in the state. How can we be attracting private financing to come to the table and work with us in partnership to build these kinds of energy projects? That's a really important part of what we're interested in seeing us achieve, because we're looking for sustainability.
Gwen, do you have any models about some of this private investment? You've spoken several times, because at the state we're always asked for money, capital project money and so forth. But if we knew that there was a way of leveraging some money to get private investment, and we knew the tax credits available, we've heard this referenced several times.
Right.
Can you provide us with that? Will you get that to me so I can distribute it to the rest of the
country? I would love to. We've put a lot of thought into how we can, a lot of times, like, for example, the Renewable Energy Fund. The way it's set up right now is that we are funding with grant funding the most economic projects first. You know, those are the ones that could probably be developed with at least some private financing if we were making that effort, you know. And also what Anthony and I have been working on is how can we bundle projects together to make them more attractive for private financing opportunities. And so those, I'm happy to provide you with as much detail as you want. These are the kinds of things that we're very interested in. We don't have, and one of the issues is when you look at the kinds of projects we do, we are very driven by where there is a where there's funding available. And so one of the things that really constrains us is that this is something we're sort of doing on the side because we're very interested in it, and we've been working with groups like Patelco to see how we can bring private funding into some of these energy projects, but we're doing it a little bit as we can. You know, I think that there's some real opportunities here to do more of that kind of work in the future, and just kind of a little bit of a mind shift about moving away from grant funding to how can we use our very limited state resources to enable projects and kind of be a catalyst toward development and not just funding stuff. And I want to point out this picture here. Did you see the little guy hanging off the end of the wind turbine blade there? This was in Nome 1 week ago, or 2 weeks ago maybe, and he's fixing the brake tip on the end of that wind turbine.
So he's not falling, is he?
No, he's not falling. But this is a mechanical problem with these particular wind turbines, these integrity wind turbines, and they are out there fixing that. That is a privately owned wind farm. They need to keep that thing running to get any funding. And that guy was up there working safely, so I should say he was safe, but working in pretty extreme conditions to get that system back online. It was a little bit of a breeze. It was really cold, and I sure wouldn't want to be up there. But that private company and developer, they're pretty motivated to keep those systems up and running. If they're down, they're fixing them. Another community that has the exact same turbine received grant funding for their project, and I'm not going to, you know, necessarily name names because it's a structural challenge that we kind of create. And they said, we have those turbines. They have that same problem. We don't fix them in the winter because we're not sending one of our guys up there.
Hmm.
It's, you know, we're not going to do it. But it was a grant-funded project. This was privately funded. There's a different mentality there, and I think we need to recognize that. And this is just the kind of thing that we, going around the state, working with all these communities, we recognize those disparities, and we're trying to figure out ways that we can work with various organizations to correct that. So, and I think that this is an example of this proposed Rural Energy Capital Fund. This is obviously part of HB, you know, 277, Senate Bill 138, big gas line bill. This is one little component where I think it gives us another opportunity to think more holistically and broadly about what we can do in the state and how all these things fit together. So I'm not going to dwell on this too much because it's obviously there's still a lot of work to be done with this particular bill.
That is in House Resources, and today that's going to be there at 1 o'clock. Are you going to be providing testimony to Resources at any time on SB 138?
I have not been asked to, but I might do that.
Maybe in the public,
and in the public,
maybe you can talk to some of us afterwards as well.
Okay,
I'd be very interested.
And I know you just have a few more minutes, so I just want to leave you with a little bit of our vision for the state. This is ASEP's vision, Alaska leading the way in innovative production, distribution, management of energy. Again, this is for us what we believe is that we can address our own very real challenges here in the state, but use that as a way to leverage a leadership position worldwide. And I just want to leave you with that thought. For us, leading the way means maximizing production of our oil and gas resources, developing local resources wherever practical, whether they're renewable or non-renewable, using innovative financing mechanisms. You know, I think that if we develop an ISO or a Transco for the Rail Belt, it should be the best one in the world because we have the opportunity to learn from what's been done other places. We should do it better. you know. And that's my personal belief. And obviously that's, you know, one of the things that's being looked at too with HB 340. I think Representative Millett's actually the sponsor of that, looking with the RCA Railboat electric utility report, you know. Diesel off is commonplace in our rural communities. This is something that our Power Systems Integration Group is really striving to achieve, working with a lot of our industry partners. And experience gained by solving our energy challenges is exported. So we're developing small businesses in Alaska that become real experts in some of these niche technologies, and we export that in a form of knowledge, and that's money that's coming back to our Alaska economy. And that's really what we're trying to achieve. Iceland's really done this for geothermal. They are the world leaders in geothermal energy. They are involved in almost every single geothermal field and development in the world. And they've got 300,000 people, but they're experts, and people call them when there's a question. And there's ways that they've set this up. There's high-quality jobs, 80 countries involved all over the world in this. And they have done this in an intentional and thought-out way. It's not an accident. They've done some things to set themselves up as the geothermal center for the world, and their university's actually been pretty critical. They bring students from around the world for free education in Iceland in geothermal energy, and when those students go back to their home country, they become the biggest advocates for bringing Icelandic companies to those countries because that's their business contacts. They know what's going on there. They invite the Icelanders in, and that's really, like, for example, with Iceland, once they had the financial crash a few years ago, one of the things that really helped them out was the fact that they had a diversified portfolio of business going on around the world, but they're using it. They mainly started because they needed to develop that expertise for their projects at home. So, you know, we've got some of these comparative advantages, too, things that we're working on, things that we're really good at. We just had a wind integration conference in Fairbanks last week, the International Wind Integration Conference. People from around the world in Fairbanks, Alaska, which is not exactly a windy place. Why is that? Because ASEP was there with our lab and what we're doing, and we're attracting people from all over the world. We have people this summer coming to us from Chile, from Nigeria, to learn about some of the things that we're doing and how it's relevant to their particular regions. We are becoming that center place, and our industries are really a key. I think the university basically serves as a catalyst to lift up this industry sector for Alaska. It can do that. Merging tech, I really encourage you to support this program. I think that the bill to extend it is HB 372. This is an important piece of a much bigger puzzle. We can't be a leader in these kinds of energy technology areas if we're not funding some of those newer projects. And those are bringing money into the state. We have people coming in here to test technology ideas here in the state. The investment that we're making there is multiplied many, many fold. I think there's a lot of opportunity to bring in match funding. The Denali Commission's done that in the past. I think there's other opportunities as well. So I think that's just an important and small piece to the bigger picture. And I do think that there's ways to use university-based research in energy to create value for the state. I don't have time to go into that right now, but we've done a lot of work on exploring models like what Texas has done, where they look at revenue-neutral research that's done through the university to support industry and can actually be documented and counted in the returns that the state sees, and they receive that research funding only based on a percentage of those returns that the state sees. So anyway, those are just my thoughts. I think that's it. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you for consolidating a two-hour report into 1 hour. We apologize. We have to leave. But are there any questions as we look at what she's presented? I know a lot of it is review, but it has to do with the issues that we're dealing with in the building at this time. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Patelco, is the $40 million include the transmission line, or is that the – that does?
Yeah, it's what they're looking at doing is investing $40 million in a transmission line and then the power generation facility out there for a 2-megawatt nominal-sized power plant, which would provide most of the baseload to Nome.
Okay. And then also I just wanted to share with the committee that the letter that she was sharing with me is from our Nome Joint Utility Manager, just applauding the great, great work, and I just wanted to say that I also agree. I've been following Gwen's work for a while and know that they're doing a great job, so thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Yes, I have a question, and I may be forgetting. This may be under Alaska Energy Authority in some way, but I'm trying to remember at your lab in Fairbanks, Do you actually, we've been talking a lot about the generation and our different options and the projects, but in your lab, do you also do testing on energy efficiency and things like that for homes?
That's a great question. What we've generally done in that case is partner with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. We're looking at more of the large-scale, community-scale power, and then, of course, there's places where that overlaps, like heat pumps, energy efficiency. We do energy efficiency at the generation level, like how do we capture waste heat and use that effectively. And so we partner pretty closely with them and consider that to be their area, so to speak, but wherever we can support them and we can contribute, we do that.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And so you maybe maybe need to direct this to the cold climate research folks, but I know that my right here in this room, the interior and the rural area, the need is the greatest and the challenges are the greatest. And at the same time, 75% of the population is in the south central area. Do you happen to know in that research, I had some home builders actually in my office recently ask about that. How much is focused on the other areas of the state, and how much is focused on that where the 75% of the homes are? Even though the need is less, with the multiplier effect, it's substantial. So, do you happen to know how much of their focus is?
Their focus is very much statewide. I mean, they've had test locations in many places, and like, for example, that ground source heat pump report that we put together focused heavily on the valley, you know, on the Palmer, Wasilla kind of area, because there's a lot of potential there and a lot of activity going on. So I can't speak for them, but I believe that a lot of those things are very translatable, and that they're looking often at built environment and home structures for northern and colder climates, but it translates all over the state, and there's even been talk about doing a demonstration in the Anchorage area related to some of the technologies that they've been pioneering.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Higgins.
Yeah, thank you. You know, let's get back to the small nuclear power plants, modular power plants. I heard you right that say that they're not economical and they're not to the point of being able to put them out yet.
They're not available. They're not available.
Well, and that brings me follow up to my question: is that if you, and I'm not saying the internet is always right. Obviously. But you've got companies out there that say they are available, mm-hmm. and we can do it, and we can do them economically. You know, like, you know, I like plug-in companies, but you look at NU scale power, which says, hey, we've got a nuclear power plant, 45 megawatt power plant that's economical, safe, mm-hmm. and we can do it.
Right.
So, but yet you tell us that's not true.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out who's saying what here.
Exactly. And I think that is one thing. Of course, you know, anyone can believe whatever they want to. We're trying to provide information, but we don't have a dog in that fight, right? We're not trying to market you a nuclear power plant. And the NuScale product in particular is set up where it's a 45 megawatt plant. They cannot be installed the way the design is right now as individual units, there isn't one that exists. There's a test bed that's been set up in Oregon, at the University at Oregon State University, I believe, but it doesn't use nuclear as a fuel. It uses natural gas as a fuel, and then they've got all the subsystems figured out. It doesn't exist right now. You can't go out and buy one if you put money on the table. And for Alaska, the challenge is that they're set up in six packs, so you've got to buy six. You can't buy an individual unit as standalone. They're not designed to operate in that way. So even if it was available and you could buy one, it wouldn't be applicable to Alaska right now. Okay. But maybe someday. So that's what we're trying to track.
Well, thanks, Gwen. Your contact information is here. I encourage us all to get in touch with you. Unfortunately, we're going to have to go, but before we do, recognize that next Wednesday, April 2nd, we're already down to the wire. At 8 a.m., we'll be back in this room, once again discussing HB 340, an act directing the RCA of Alaska to provide a report to the legislature regarding electric transmission. With that, we stand adjourned.